Chapter 7. Patience Camp. The apathy which seemed to take possession of some of the men at the frustration of their hopes was soon dispelled. Parties were sent out daily in different directions to look for seals and penguins. We had left, other than reserve sledging rations, about 110 pounds of pemmican, including the dog pemmican, and 300 pounds of flour. In addition, there was a little tea, sugar, dried vegetables, and suet. I sent Hurley and Macklin to Ocean Camp to bring back the food that we had had to leave there. They returned with quite a good load, including 130 pounds of dry milk, about 50 pounds each of dog pemmican and jam, and a few tins of potted meats. When they were about a mile and a half away, their voices were quite audible to us at Ocean Camp, so still was the air. We were, of course, very short of the farinaceous element in our diet. The flour would last 10 weeks. After that, our sledging rations would last us less than 3 months. Our meals had to consist mainly of seal and penguin, and though this was valuable as an antiscorbutic, so much so that not a single case of scurvy occurred among the party, yet it was a badly adjusted diet, and we felt rather weak and enervated in consequence. The cook deserves much praise for the way he has stuck to his job through all this severe blizzard. His galley consists of nothing but a few boxes arranged as a table, with a canvas screen erected around them on 4 oars, and the 2 blubber stoves within. The protection afforded by the screen is only partial, and the eddies drive the pungent blubber smoke in all directions. After a few days, we were able to build him an igloo of ice blocks with a tarpaulin over the top as a roof. Our rations are just sufficient to keep us alive, but we all feel that we could eat twice as much as we get. An average day's food at present consists of 1/2 pound of seal with 3/4 of a pint of tea for breakfast, a 4-ounce bannock with milk for lunch, and 3/4 of a pint of seal stew for supper. That is barely enough, even doing very little work as we are, for of course we are completely destitute of bread or potatoes or anything of that sort. Some seem to feel it more than others, and are continually talking of food. But most of us find that the continual conversation about food only whets an appetite that cannot be satisfied. Our craving for bread and butter is very real, not because we cannot get it, but because the system feels the need of it. Owing to this shortage of food and the fact that we needed all that we could get for ourselves, I had to order all the dogs except 2 teams to be shot. It was the worst job that we had had throughout the expedition, and we felt their loss keenly. I had to be continually rearranging the weekly menu. The possible number of permutations of seal meat were decidedly limited. The fact that the men did not know what was coming gave them a sort of mental speculation, and the slightest variation was of great value. We caught an adelie today, January 26th, and another whale was seen at close quarters, but no seals. We are now very short of blubber, and in consequence 1 stove has to be shut down. We only get 1 hot beverage a day, the tea at breakfast. For the rest, we have iced water. Sometimes we are short even of this, so we take a few chips of ice in a tobacco tin to bed with us. In the morning, there is about 1 spoonful of water in the tin, and one has to lie very still all night so as not to spill it. To provide some variety in the food, I commenced to use the sledging ration at 1/2 strength twice a week. The ice between us and Ocean Camp, now only about 5 miles away and actually to the southwest of us, was very broken, but I decided to send Macklin and Hurley back with their dogs to see if there were any more food that could be added to our scanty stock. I gave them written instructions to take no undue risk or cross any wide-open leads, and said that they were to return by midday the next day. Although they both fell through the thin ice up to their waists more than once, they managed to reach the camp. They found the surface soft and sunk about 2 feet. Ocean Camp, they said, looked like a village that had been razed to the ground and deserted by its inhabitants. The floorboards forming the old tent bottoms had prevented the sun from thawing the snow directly underneath them, and were in consequence raised about 2 feet above the level of the surrounding floe. The storehouse next the galley had taken on a list of several degrees to starboard, and pools of water had formed everywhere. They collected what food they could find, and packed a few books in a Venesta sledging case, returning to Patience Camp by about 8 p.m. I was pleased at their quick return, and as their report seemed to show that the road was favourable, on February 2nd I sent back 18 men under Wild to bring all the remainder of the food and the 3rd boat, the Stancomb Wills. They started off at 1 a.m., towing the empty boat sledge on which the James Caird had rested, and reached Ocean Camp about 3:30 a.m. We stayed about 3 hours at the camp, mounting the boat on the sledge, collecting eatables, clothing, and books. We left at 6 a.m., arriving back at Patience Camp with the boat at 12:30 p.m., taking exactly 3 times as long to return with the boat as it did to pull in the empty sledge to fetch it. On the return journey, we had numerous halts, while the pioneer party of 4 were busy breaking down pressure ridges and filling in open cracks with ice blocks as the leads were opening up. The sun had softened the surface a good deal, and in places it was terribly hard pulling. Everyone was a bit exhausted by the time we got back, as we are not now in good training and are on short rations. Every now and then the heavy sledge broke through the ice altogether and was practically afloat. We had an awful job to extricate it, exhausted as we were. The longest distance which we managed to make without stopping for leads or pressure ridges was about 3/4 of a mile. About 1 mile from Patience Camp, we had a welcome surprise. Sir Ernest and Hussey sledged out to meet us with dixies of hot tea, well wrapped up to keep them warm. One or two of the men left behind had cut a moderately good track for us into the camp, and they harnessed themselves up with us, and we got in fine style. One excellent result of our trip was the recovery of 2 cases of lentils, weighing 42 pounds each. The next day I sent Macklin and Crean back to make a further selection of the gear, but they found that several leads had opened up during the night, and they had to return when within 1.5 miles of their destination. We were never able to reach Ocean Camp again. Still, there was very little left there that would have been of use to us. By the middle of February, the blubber question was a serious one. I had all the discarded seals' heads and flippers dug up and stripped of every vestige of blubber. Meat was very short, too. We still had our 3 month supply of sledging food practically untouched. We were only to use this as a last resort. We had a small supply of dog pemmican, the dogs that were left being fed on those parts of the seals that we could not use. This dog pemmican we fried in suet with a little flour and made excellent bannocks. Our meat supply was now very low indeed. We were reduced to just a few scraps. Fortunately, however, we caught 2 seals and 4 emperor penguins, and next day 40 adelies. We had now only 40 days' food left, and the lack of blubber was being keenly felt. All our suet was used up, so we used seal blubber to fry the meat in. Once we were used to its fishy taste, we enjoyed it. In fact, like Oliver Twist, we wanted more. On Leap Year Day, February 29th, we held a special celebration, more to cheer the men up than for anything else. Some of the cynics of the party held that it was to celebrate their escape from woman's wiles for another 4 years. The last of our cocoa was used today. Henceforth, water, with an occasional drink of weak milk, is to be our only beverage. 3 lumps of sugar were now issued to each man daily. One night one of the dogs broke loose and played havoc with our precious stock of bannocks. He ate 4 and half of a fifth before he could be stopped. The remaining half, with the marks of the dog's teeth on it, I gave to Worsley, who divided it up amongst his 7 tent mates. They each received about 1/2 square inch. Lees, who was in charge of the food and responsible for its safe keeping, wrote in his diary, "The shorter the provisions, the more there is to do in the commissariat department, contriving to eke out our slender stores as the weeks pass by. No housewife ever had more to do than we have in making a little go a long way." Writing about the bannock that Peter bit makes one wish now that one could have many a meal that one has given to the dog at home. When one is hungry, fastidiousness goes to the winds, and one is only too glad to eat up any scraps, regardless of their antecedents. One is almost ashamed to write of all the tidbits one has picked up here, but it is enough to say that when the cook upset some pemmican onto an old sooty cloth and threw it outside his galley, one man subsequently made a point of acquiring it and scraping off the palatable but dirty compound. Another man searched for over 1 hour in the snow where he had dropped a piece of cheese some days before, in the hopes of finding a few crumbs. He was rewarded by coming across a piece as big as his thumbnail, and considered it well worth the trouble. By this time blubber was a regular article of our diet, either raw, boiled, or fried. It is remarkable how our appetites have changed in this respect. Until quite recently, almost the thought of it was nauseating. Now, however, we positively demand it. the thick black oil which is rendered down from it, rather like train oil in appearance and cod liver oil in taste, we drink with avidity.